Innovation and creativity are central to entrepreneurship. But what happens when you go beyond the edge? The Frontier Entrepreneurship Podcast brings you the world's first, the disruptive, the avant-garde. We take you to the frontier in conversation with the entrepreneurs who are the forerunners of the industries of the future. Get to know their world with co-hosts Braden Kemp and Tracy Morningstar.
On the cusp of an age of expanded galactic exploration, as humanity launches more and more satellites into orbit, and as the world's space agencies mount ever more elaborate missions, and as global reconnaissance becomes critical to data-driven geospatial applications of all kinds, the need to secure communication between Earth and space has become a top priority. Today, we literally look to the exosphere with Jacqueline Good, founder and CEO of Canadian space tech startup, Magnastar.
I'm Braden Kemp, here today with my co-host Tracy Morningstar. Hello, Tracy.
Hello.
We have a really interesting guest today, and I'm excited for this conversation. Jacqueline Good is the founder and CEO of Magnastar, a technology company that ensures connectivity in contested and congested environment of satellite communications. In the last 18 months, Jacqueline has graduated from Entrepreneur First, graduated from the Creative Destruction Lab Space Stream, completed Techstars with the Saudi Space Commission, won Startup Fest 2022 Best of Fest and Best Pitch, and won the Satellite 2023 Star Award. Jacqueline, welcome, and it sounds like you've been busy.
Yes, I would say that we've been quite busy over the past 18 months or so, quite the journey so far. But yes, thank you so much for having me. I'm thrilled to be here today.
We've spoken really briefly before, and I think I asked you the highly specific and technical question of how is the space business? And maybe that illustrates what I assume to be a general lack of understanding that average people like myself have about satellite communication. So to help us understand the rest of the conversation, can you break down the basics of how satellite communication works and the type of products and services that rely on those communications being functional?
Absolutely. So in terms of how satellite communications work today, satellite communications primarily work through a radio frequency spectrum. So spectrum is allocated on behalf of the International Telecommunications Union and then through regional administrations. Whichever country you're in, you request spectrum as an allocation to your country, and then you get that allocation of spectrum. And from there, you're able to communicate back and forth to Earth. It involves a lot of antenna systems, ground station technology, all of what's being innovated quite quickly on as well within our realm. And from that, that's how the basis of space communications work. The more some of the cutting edge work that's being done as well is around optical communications, so using light. And in that, we look at that quite closely as well, as we're part of the Optical Consortium of Canada. And we do quite a bit of advanced research than optical communications, as well as overall interference. It's important to note as well that within Canada, specifically in terms of the country itself, so much of our country relies on satellite connectivity. It's quite startling. I think that when I first was building the company, I came across this article about Iqaluit, Nunavut, and they lost satellite connectivity and they were unable to get gas. They were unable to get money out of ATMs. They were unable to get groceries. They were unable to really shut down the entire city when these systems go down. And so we realized quite quickly that actually increasing the resiliency of satellite communications, especially as we go from 8,000 satellites in space to well over 100,000 satellites in space, it's a growing issue and it's going to be in need of great technical advancements. And that's why we built the company around solving for signal interference and ensuring resiliency of space communications.
That's fantastic. You mentioned the term spectrum, and it's something I came across doing some background as well. Can you explain spectrum to me like I'm your 15-year-old neighbor?
Absolutely. So if you're my 15-year-old neighbor, this past weekend I was at the cottage. So I'm thinking about my neighbors at the cottage now. But it's basically the echoes of sound. And when you think about any radio transpondence you get, there is a range of frequencies of spectrum that can be leveraged. It's just the density of the wave formation. So if you think about it, you're at a cottage and you're looking at the lake, you see a boat go by, and depending on the speed of the boat, it's often very big waves or smaller waves, faster waves, the waves that are closer together, further apart. And spectrum works quite similarly in that the density of the waves and how close they are together, and the overall height of the wave depends on how much gigahertz can be communicated at a given time. And that's how spectrum works. So a lot of folks in the space sector use the higher range of spectrum in more of like the 20 to 30 to 40 gigahertz range, for especially with communication spectrum, which just means that the density in which the communication is being transmitted between two different places.
You used one of my favorite things on the planet, boats, to describe something that I absolutely didn't understand until now. So that might be my favorite answer we've ever had.
Was that helpful? Is that clear?
Absolutely, yes.
Okay, cool. I think about that all the time, though. Whenever I'm at the cottage and I see all these waves coming off the boats, I'm always like, ah, yes, it's like the waves of spectrum. And even when you create like ripples in the water, it's the same thing. It's a really nice visual that you can use to describe radio frequency spectrum.
I think it's wonderful.
Now, my question might be a little not too sophisticated, but Magnusstar, your company name, my last name's Morningstar, and culturally, names mean something. I was just wondering, you know, how did you come up with the name?
When I was building the company, I was in a program called Entrepreneur First. Entrepreneur First is a talent accelerator. They had a number of cohorts come through Toronto. I think they went 4 or 5 cohorts, and then they actually ended up moving it down south. But when I was going through, we were the second cohort in Toronto. And in that cohort, there were 70 of us that first started in, and the entire idea is to find a co-founder. And this would have been almost 2 years ago now that we kicked it off. But when I was going through Entrepreneur First, it was fantastic because I just was able to connect with so many different people who wanted to build companies. And everyone, every time you go through it, you connect with a co-founder, you work with them for 2, 3 days, 2 weeks, whatever that might look like, or you pair up with someone and work for them with them forever. But in my case, I was just sort of experimenting with different founders. And you ended up meeting a ton of friends through the cohort who also are very entrepreneurial minded, as I mentioned. And one of those people, I was having lunch with them one day, and the original concept that we had created when we were building Magnusstar was actually, it was very highly tied with magnetics and using magnetic power. I often think about magnetism in general when it comes to Earth's magnetic core and how Earth was formed. And I was thinking about that and reading quite a number of books about that at the time. And even like in terms of the north magnetic pole of the Earth is actually in Nunavut. So for some reason, all my lines are leaning to Nunavut. with that, the way we came up with the name was I was thinking about magna and magnets and magnetism and electromagnetic spectrum is the electromagnetic spectrum that's used in all space communications. And then I was having lunch with someone and they're like, what if you put a star on it? Because it's almost like a star that you want to build. And so that's what we came up with Magnusstar. It was just through lunch at the Mars building and brainstorming names with fellow entrepreneurial-minded people. And that's how we came up with the name, and we stuck with it ever since.
I appreciate that. Absolutely. And one of the things, Morningstar, what we believe in is what's above is below. And then that's when I was thinking about your company. I was thinking the satellites, what's above, and then obviously you're connecting on what's below. So I just thought that related.
Oh yeah, no, I think about that all the time. I actually have a ring that I'm wearing right now that has, it has like, there's 4 diamonds on the top and then there's 4 diamonds on the bottom. And that's to signify as above, as below. So why I'm right in your line of thinking, Tracy.
Nice. I believe we may have somebody in common, Stacey Jack. She's on the board of the Royal Ontario Museum. And I wanted to talk a little bit about mentors, more about peer mentors. And I just thought you would give a little bit of insight on that.
Absolutely. In terms of my peer mentors, so I would say my peer mentors, I have a number of them. The space community is very unique in the way that it's a very small community, and it's incredibly encouraging. I worked in a variety of different sectors, and by far space is the most optimistic, which I love. I find it whenever I'm at space events, which we go to quite often, space is very in person, space is very hands-on. And so we go to all these different events and you get to meet so many like-minded people, but everybody just wants the best for the planet and the best for space and to ensure that we're building a sustainable future. And that's why I find the most encouraging. I was even reading this article and it was a spinoff of NASA between over like a 10-year period had over 300 technology transfers into other sectors. because so much of the advancements in terms of cutting edge tech, things that you're pushing the boundaries with, happens for space technology. And then it trickles down into other sectors, which I find is so fascinating. That's what we do here at Magnastar as well. I would say in terms of my mentors specifically, a couple come to mind. A number of them are advisors. I found them through a variety of different ways, actually. There's one mentor that I had that I currently have that I worked with previously. I've known him for 5 or 6 years now. And it was actually when I was in my previous job, I was doing enterprise sales for a large software company. And this is like infrastructure, data infrastructure work. So deep technical, like deep data tech. And when I was there, we were at a bank and I was talking about how we were actually building up their systems to be resilient against future crashes, basically preventing the economic turndown of 2008 happening again. And I was in the room with him and I was with a much more senior sales executive. I was the solution engineer at the time who was building up these systems and how they were going to connect with their existing software or their existing data infrastructure. And we were in the room and, you know, the senior executive had finished their questions and he was like, all right, thank you so much for your time. And I actually asked to stay in the room to continue the conversation with this, at the time, senior vice president of data and advanced analytics and artificial intelligence for the bank. And we ended up just really clicking. Like, he had sold a company before. He had built incredible infrastructure. He had run the data and analytics for two of the major banks in Canada. And we ended up connecting and just sort of like throughout the number of years since then, connecting on a recurring basis. And then once we kicked things off at Magnastar and I saw a position where he could really, where I needed his assistance, I pulled him back in. But he always had this vision that I thought was really unique for Canada, in that he always believed, he was doing a bunch of financial literacy teaching in elementary schools and middle schools and just trying to build up the financial acumen of you know, the everyday Canadian. And he's like, I just see a future where everybody, we're all entrepreneurs and we all have businesses and we all have small businesses or medium businesses aiming to build large businesses. And the more businesses that we have, the more partnerships that are established, the more innovation that occurs and the better off that we will be. And I thought that was so brilliant. And I think that that really inspired me as well to take the path of entrepreneurship more seriously. So I think it's, for me, the biggest way I've always obtained the peer mentors that I have is either through doing things like that, where I come across somebody who is just really remarkable and I can learn a ton from, and just continuously asking them questions if they're open to it. And the other side of that has been through more formal mentorship programs that we went through with CDL, the Creative Destruction Lab, where we had about 80 to 100 mentors providing us advice and guidance on our business for 6 months, and then achieving some really great mentors through that program. And then even on the peer side, I have sort of a community of space entrepreneurs that I connect with almost every week. And we've done stories off of like what's working, what they're seeing in the industry, all those great things.
You mentioned the path of entrepreneurship there. This is a highly technical business, and you don't strike me as someone who just randomly starts a space company out of the blue. I imagine there was quite a process you went through to dial in on managing space communications data. Mm. How do you get there?
Yes. So for me, when I was in my previous roles, I had always in my mind knew that I at some point likely wanted to start a business. I was in university in undergrad and I was reading a lot of Malcolm Gladwell books. And Malcolm Gladwell writes a lot about outliers and David and Goliath and these desirable disabilities, as he calls them, and things that make people unique, and specifically the things that I had in my life outlined very well with entrepreneurship and made me very well suited from a personality perspective to be an entrepreneur. And so I always had that in the sort of the back of my mind. And then it really came about when I was working for OMERS, the pension fund, and advocating for space investments, because I recognized that all of a sudden it was this booming sector. We had sent over 600 people to space and we no longer needed to be an astronaut to go to space. And it almost seemed like the floodgates were opening up, especially as, you know, folks are putting in hundreds of thousands of satellites into space and it's only growing. And the International Space Station is retiring in 2030. So there's multiple new space stations that are being put up. And I think I recognized that, you know, there's this massive shift that's happening in the space sector right now. And it's really a turning point. And for our generation coming up, the opportunities to go to space and to be a part of the space sector have never been stronger. And so from that perspective, I was advocating quite a bit within OMERS for space investments and whatnot. But I think I just came to realize that I was at this TechCrunch, space tech conference online, because it was during the pandemic. And I was hearing all these incredible space entrepreneurs talking about their visions. And I realized that if I was able to be a part of that and really execute on the vision I had to build a space company, that would be fantastic. And I think that within my background, like, I've worked with all five banks in Canada in terms of their data infrastructure and their data architecture and rebuilding their data architecture. I've worked with four of the pension funds, multiple high-tech manufacturers, multiple retailers across Canada, three of the Canadian airports, multiple airports, as well as retailers and financial firms in the U.S. And then I've also been educated in China and Europe. So from that standpoint, and worked within those markets as well. And so I had a really global perspective. To me, I had worked with so much data at that point, and that's the best thing about data. It's so transferable. And so by me being trained as a data scientist and having an understanding of a very strong understanding of how data architecture and systems work together, I was well positioned to tackle a very large problem with a very strong data solution. And then it took us actually going and me being a part of Entrepreneur First for the first 6 months of the business and really just asking as many people in the space sector how to solve the mega problems. And also when I was leaving OMERS, I went to the International Space University and got funding from the European Space Agency to study space engineering. And so from that standpoint, I had a 4-month program, or it was about 3 months of intensive, like 16-hour days working with all of the major experts in space that they were bringing in on a weekly basis, just to talk about the biggest issues in space and how I could potentially use my skill set in data architecture and data infrastructure and high-speed data processing in order to solve a very large issue in the space sector and really accelerate all the goals that space operators have in mind and again, ensure that resiliency of all space architecture.
I wanted to ask you about the Space University. How does a school like that come about? Where is it? And how do you end up there?
Yes. So the way this school came about, it was actually founded, I believe, out of MIT. So there was four folks at MIT who wanted to build something that specifically focused on space. And it came about in the 1980s. So it's about 40 years old now as a school. And they specifically focus on space programming. So they have a master's program as well as a space studies program, which occurs over the summertime. And the summer one is the one that I did. But it was fun. It was phenomenal. You learn every single aspect of space. You're surrounded by people who work in space. Majority of people who go through the program have a background in space engineering or aerospace engineering and are working for different defense agencies across the world and specifically building space infrastructure. So it was a really great combination of folks working on cutting edge space technology, whether that be creating new frequency bands and experimenting with new communication opportunities in space, everything to building satellite systems, to working with the astronauts on the ISS and running their workload for them. So there was a really great variety in terms of folks that are part of it. But how I got there was honestly just through connecting with everybody I knew who worked in the space sector and telling them that I wanted to move from the data tech to the space sector and how was the best way for me to do that, knowing that I wanted to build a company. So I ended up connecting with a friend at Rocket Lab, which is one of the largest space companies in the world. And she mentioned to me that going to the International Space University would be the best approach. I then connected with somebody who runs a company called Space Entrepreneurs in Seattle. And he was the one who actually put me forward for the International Space University because he said that's the best approach if I wanted to go from data tech to space tech and build a space company. And then I also met with a professor at MIT who is head of the system engineering as well as working in the aerospace group at MIT. And he mentioned to me that if I wanted to build a space company, the best place to do that would be at the International Space University, as most folks going through their programs are doing full PhDs, and I wanted to build as soon as possible. So that's the way I sort of did it. I just connected with everybody I knew who worked in the space sector, and they all told me to go to the International Space University, and then that's where I ended up finding a really strong network of people in the space sector to connect with, as well as mentors and advisors that remain on our advisory committee of the company today.
Okay, we talked about mentors, advisors. How do you, as a small business owner, get people to come and join your team?
Honestly, Tracy, I would say that there's a lot of folks that want to work in space. We just put a job posting up about a month ago now and had over 400 people apply for a single. Yeah, no, the amount of, and I think it helps that we are, you know, we're an award-winning space company now. We have won majority of industry awards. We've gone through the distinguished accelerator programs that sort of put the check mark of approval that we've been through the ringer and that what we're doing is strong and has great promise. And we've situated ourselves very nicely to solve a really like a game-changing problem in the space sector and for the world that has the opportunity to have significant impact. And from that standpoint, I think that from an engineering point of view, whenever I talk to folks who are applying for engineering roles, that's what they're really looking for is a really big problem with a solution that has the capacity to work and solve that problem at scale, and that is going to have a game-changing impact on the world and beyond that, to be honest. But that's what it really comes down to, and that's what we are positioning it as. I think that from our standpoint, we've had, like I mentioned, that was one job. We had over 400 people apply, but we've had a really strong intake of folks wanting to work in the space sector, and we've hired fantastic talent. And I think it's been the most exciting to me. I was interviewing for this operations position. This was a couple months back, and the one person said, you know, I've been waiting for a role like this. I've been waiting for something like this to become available at like an early stage, up and coming, really strong company in a fantastically, you know, interesting growing field. I also think that because of the war in Ukraine and the renewed focus on continental defense, as well as Canadian defense, we're in a good position because we're in such a growing market right now that's resistant to any kind of turndowns that may be experienced elsewhere, because defense really touches everything. And I think people really care about it. My family's been in Canada for generations on generations, and like having the opportunity to build technology to protect our people and to protect people in space and to protect our land. And that's very exciting to me to have that kind of impact. I think others feel that as well.
It sounds like a company on a great trajectory. Without being too specific, who are your customers, and like tactically, what does your technology do to make a difference for them?
Yes. So our customers are satellite operators, as well as the regulators who are distributing the spectrum. Specifically on the satellite operator side, how they're using our technology, you can think of it in a couple different ways. You can think of it as, I applied for spectrum, I have my allocation, now I need to coordinate with all the other operators who are within my same band operating the same region and make sure we don't interfere with each other. And we build technology to assist with those coordinations and to ensure compliance of those coordination agreements. You can think of it as, I've taken an image of a forest fire, I need to communicate that image to Earth. Am I going to be interfered with by another operator, or will I have a clear path of connectivity? We can tell you that type of information as well directly through our software platform. And if you're a regulator and you're distributing spectrum, or folks are asking for changes within their allocation, is it going to cause interference, or will folks still be able to communicate clearly between Earth and space? So those are sort of three of the prime use cases that we run through, is going through the process of coordinating in the real-time implications of whether or not you'll have a clear path of connectivity. And as well for allocation of the spectrum, will there be any interference, or will you have clear communication for all of your different licensees as a part of being a regulator? In terms of how our technology actually works, our technology works through, we run simulations and we embed that within technology that connects operators to each other. And in doing so, we are able to run simulations at 10x the speed they're able to run them today. And we do it through a software platform that's easy from everyone within the operating team, as well as the regulatory team, legal teams, and up to the C-suite to use. It's really important, mostly because, again, it's their connectivity. Like, this is the resiliency of their communications and all their services for their customers. And it also cues directly into the revenue as well, which is why it's really applicable to ensure they have really secure, strong connectivity for all their users, as well as for making their shareholders happy. And that's why we found a really nifty problem, as I mentioned, to solve. And we have agreement from the majority of sector that we're solving it in the correct way, and that they're happy that we're happy on how we're positioning the technology and on board with it.
I can tell Tracy has a question, but I have two follow-ups, so I'm jumping back in. This analysis that's happening, are we talking about real time, near real time, next Tuesday? Like, how much lead time do you need to get that information back to the customer?
Yeah. So in terms of predicting the interference itself, we can predict interference on either a two-year basis. So over the next 2 years, what's the likelihood of you being interfered with? Or in the next 10 minutes, am I going to be interfered with? So we are moving towards as much real time as possible so that we can know in real time whether or not there will be an interference case. And if there was interference, what caused that interference? How do we remediate that action? But it's all towards, when it really comes down to it, is predicting the interference events and then ensuring the high throughput connectivity for all operators to maintain very strong, feasible service.
Okay. And the next follow-up is what's the industry doing right now to avoid that interference? I assume there's some sort of status quo that you're disrupting.
Yeah. So the status quo, it's really based on the evolving market, though. There is some status quo technology that's being used. Or we found the biggest opportunity, though, is that most of the status quo technology was being created for geostationary satellite operators. So you think about satellites that are very far away from Earth, and it's created for those folks that are very far away from Earth. And they have those multiple satellite operators that are geostationary, so they're staying in one position, coordinating with one another and ensuring high throughput capacity. The difference is that as we move into the non-geostationary, so in lower Earth orbit, tons of satellites moving at a high speed, 7 kilometers per second at times, so very high speed satellites moving, how do we ensure that all those operators that are coming in to the lower Earth operating market, that they have high throughput connectivity as well? And that's the new market that we're servicing, along with the geostationary market that exists today.
Fantastic.
We always want our entrepreneurs to be giving back. I'm not too sure how being on board of the Royal Ontario Museum, how does that connect with space technology?
Yes. So I've been on the board of, one of the executive committees of the Royal Ontario Museum, called the Bishop White Committee. I've been a part of that committee longer than I've been running Magnastar. So that's just honestly personal passion for me. I used to live in China. I used to work in and go to school in China. So, and I have a diploma in Chinese language and literature. And so when I came back and I was living in Toronto, I just wanted to find a way to maintain those connections. And I love art and I love the ROM. I was finding myself, living in Toronto and spending every other weekend going to the ROM. and just looking at all the different artifacts and really queuing in. And so I actually reached out to the Bishop White Committee. The Bishop White Committee manages the Asian galleries, all the art coming in, the curation, the endowment, and everything else. And so I got connected. I wrote a letter to them saying that I wanted to get involved. And then I heard back a number of months later saying that there was an opening and that I could come interview for it. So I went and I interviewed. And that was, oh my gosh, three, four years ago now that I've been engaged with that. And it's honestly, I found especially during when everyone's in lockdown, it was such a nice thing to have that was completely separate from anything I was doing at work, a really good outlet that was creative and artistic, and they had experts come and speak on a regular basis. So if anybody's interested in Asian art, I'd recommend just sort of checking into the Bishop White Committee website regularly, and they always have different exhibitions and speakers coming to talk, and they do different like dinners and whatnot at the best restaurants, and it's really fun to be a part of. So I'd encourage, and it's an open committee that, well, the executive part is specific, but we do have a ton of different members from around the world who participate in the events that we host. So that's been a really fun part of my life that I've enjoyed for the last number of years that I like to continue on with. And then the other ways that we give back, we did sign up to the Upside Foundation as Magnastar. So Magnastar is a part of the Upside Foundation. It means that at any point of liquidity as a company, a certain percentage will go towards charitable foundations. And so that's what we've already agreed to as well. And we already have those sort of charities outlined for us that we really care about and want to get back to regularly.
Nice. I really like that. Because when I think about what the museums have to offer is a little bit to do with the past and looking at the past into the future. That's really nice.
Oh my gosh, it's phenomenal. I love being a part of it. And it's the most unique group of people. We have one person who's was a former head of the Canadian Mining Association and worked as an engineer for 30 years. And when I was even first building Magnastar and he He's like an older gentleman, but he's still building companies and working on really cool projects. So it was really fun just getting to know him better as well as we went through the process of working together at the Bishop White Committee, and you know, growing and learning from each other and seeing the different things that come that are coming into the ROM and seeing all the art. I love that part, and I would encourage anybody listening that if there is, you know, if you love art or if there's any kind of passion that you have, finding a way to do it through volunteering to just keep that on the side, I really enjoyed. And I would encourage that. And I find that everyone on the Bishop White Committee ends up starting on it, and then they never leave. They're members who have been there for like 50 years. And we have members that pass away, and we do like big events for them, and we donate to the library for them, and we bring an art for them. And it's just a really beautiful community of people that I'm really happy to be a part of.
You're taking on leading a startup, completing various accelerators, networking around the globe, hiring a team, giving back. And you said earlier that you'd just been at the cottage last week. How do you manage all these time commitments, and do you sleep?
Yes, I definitely sleep. I'm a great sleeper. When you do a lot. How do I manage all my time commitments? I think that for me, it's a mixture of, I think I've always worked a lot, like throughout. One of the reasons why I've done so much education and worked and then also my volunteering things is because I've always done all three at the same time. And that's been since I was basically in high school. I mean, in high school, I never worked, but I did do volunteering throughout high school and then starting university. I always had like little part-time jobs here and there. And then I'd be in school full-time and volunteering as well. So it was always really important to me that I had all those sort of facets. And I think that that built up a really strong work ethic, in that I'm very good at just getting things done and understanding and prioritizing tasks. I would say that come sort of in April, May of this year, it did get a bit overwhelming. And then I hired somebody to come on and really help with that workload. So I think it's all a balance, and I take time whenever I need it. I take long weekends. I listen to my team, because I find that the biggest thing as a founder, and I've talked about this previously at different events, is that we tend to build the companies that are echoes of ourselves. And so in me being a very hardworking individual who's multifaceted and is sort of like cruising, she was more boat analogies, cruising at all times. And I know that like I can work myself too hard at times, and I'm very cognizant of that now. And in order to build a sustainable, long-term developing company, I have to be at my best at all times, and that means, like I mentioned, taking long weekends and taking time when I can, and all the rest of it. So I encourage my team to do the same, actually, because I know that this company being an echo of myself, I will occasionally work people and have very high expectations of them. So, but we always make sure that we balance that with making sure they get a good time off. Whenever folks are working a lot of overtime, we give them an extra day to take with their families, and we really just balance it in that capacity. And I try to echo that within my own behavior to make sure that that balance is still there for, again, the sustainability of the company.
I love hearing I take the time when I need it. You see and hear all this, you know, hustle culture content, never stop, do whatever it takes. I think it's generally terrible advice. And you do have to slow down and you know, make time for other things in life. So that's great to hear.
Mm-hmm. Oh my gosh. And I love being at the water and boating. And I'm a big sailor too. I've been doing all my sailing certifications this summer. And so I've been taking like my weekends and then my evenings to do sailing, and just making sure that I have all my certifications so that I'm also learning to fly. But I felt like I had to learn to fully, I've been sailing my whole life, but to really sail and be an expert at it before I learned to fly. And so that's been so much fun, though, just to get out of the office and go sailing for an afternoon, get on the water for 3 or 4 hours. And oh my gosh, it gets your head out of anything else. And there was one book that I was reading about burnout and like just managing stress. And it talks a lot about, I read a lot of books, obviously, as it goes, as a CEO and people. But in the book, it talks about how you have to like close the stress loops, and how important it is to close the stress loops in order to actually get over that stress and to recover properly from it. And if you have a ton of open stress loops, that just adds additional stress and it makes it unmanageable and it causes burnout. So whenever we're going through a really stressful time or a stressful, you know, even like a stressful meeting, whatever that might look like, I always make sure that I'm closing that stress loop either through going out for a run or going for a sail or hanging out and reading a book, or if I just want to, like, you know, chat with my dad for a while, like just making sure that you're always closing those stress loops and getting rid of it. And that way you can really move on and maintain a healthy mental state.
I think that's great advice for entrepreneurs, but people in general.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And I like that you went a little further on that, because I was part of a group discussion and it was about mental health amongst entrepreneurs. And it's definitely something that people are talking about today, where it wasn't talked about previous to COVID, but I'm happy to see that those discussions are happening now.
Absolutely. Likewise, I think it's really important. And I think that, and to Brandon's point, like the whole hustle till you can't hustle anymore is, it's just not sustainable. So let's build something that we can continue building a decade from now.
We call this show the Frontier Entrepreneurship Podcast. And I want to come back around to that. And I'm going to try to put together an analogy. And if you have a better one, because you've had some great ones, feel free. If we sort of put the frontier of the space sector in the lens of something like the gold rush, where are we in that cycle? Is it, you know, one prospector who's gone up a mountain and found a nugget? Are the masses on their way up with pickaxes? How far are we to space as something that's common in the day-to-day life of the consumer?
Oh, I think that in terms of how common it is to the consumer, I think that space technology is much more common than people are aware of. Every time that you get in an Uber or use your Google Maps or Waze, every time that you tap your phone to do a financial transaction, every time that you get on a phone call or use any kind of cellular reception, you're using space technology. So it's like, it has been this way for a number, for a decade now, again, with those geostationary satellite operators who provide that type of connectivity. I would say it's only massively growing, and the opportunities in terms of working in space, being in space, and how the space sector is going to grow. From that regard, I would say we're at base camp. Like, if we're climbing Everest towards these big audacious goals, we are currently at base camp, and the opportunities that are going to be at that top of the mountain are, some people say, like, infinite, just because it's additional space stations that are being built. If we have 1 million people living in space, what kind of economy does that drive? And so from that perspective, we can talk about sort of the immediate outcomes of providing internet to the unconnected, which a number of companies are doing today. But then when it goes beyond that, of providing space stations, providing alternative places for people to live. And even when we look at Canada, like, so much of Canada is unpopulated. And I love that, because it's all the tundra and we've had to protect the tundra. And at the same time, there are communities in Northern Canada that are ready to flourish and that are ready for that type of investment. And one of the conversations we were having, which I think might put it into sort of some perspective, was, this is a part of the optical group that I'm a part of, and we were having a sort of a side conversation with a couple of folks, and we were talking about connectivity in the north and how critical it is to increase connectivity in the north, because even as we think about migration patterns and with climate change coming, I think the number of people looking to move north and looking to move to cooler climates is also going to increase. And I think that as Canadians, we have to be prepared for that. And that preparedness comes from connecting the north and ensuring that if I'm in the north, like deep north, and I want to work for Salesforce and live the life of me in the woods working for Salesforce and having a strong enough connection to be able to jump on video calls and jump on any sort of interaction from a customer perspective that I need to work through and be an account executive for Salesforce, working anywhere, that is something that will become possible. And I think that it's going to give humans so much more flexibility in terms of where we want to live. And from that standpoint, we really are on the frontier of that today, I would say. And at that base camp stage where the primary infrastructure has been built, and it's continuing to be built. But as we go from living on the moon, which is set to occur within the next decade or so as well, establishing a base on the moon, having multiple you know, hundreds of thousands of non-million people living on space stations, and then also going to Mars, Jupiter, and beyond. I think that it's really only growing up. And again, the trickle-down effect that has on other sectors is also something that I'm particularly excited about, that we had the opportunity to accomplish.
Tracy, unless you have something really specific to follow up there, I think that's a really great place to end it.
I was thinking the exact same thing.
We talk to entrepreneurs from all different industries on this show who are on the frontier of their various industries, but this is the first time we've been able to talk about a frontier that's sort of unfolding for civilization, and I think that's pretty cool. So thank you, Jacqueline, for taking the time to chat with us today.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Jacqueline.
Thank you so much.
We'll be right back after this short break.
Did you know that NCFDC delivers a National Woman Entrepreneurship Loan Fund? Delia offers $15,000 loans to qualifying Canadian woman-owned businesses at competitive rates. Head to delia.fund for more information and to apply today.
We return to the Frontier Entrepreneurship Podcast with co-hosts Braden Kemp and Tracy Morningstar.
Tracy, that was absolutely incredible. Jacqueline's a great example of an entrepreneur who's done her homework and used data to make decisions all along the path to create what I think is going to be an incredibly successful company. I'm leaving that conversation with an understanding of an industry that I'll admit I knew nothing about an hour ago.
Myself, same. For her to explain that we are now only at the base camp gives me optimism that we still have time to catch up.
Yep, it's a pretty unique industry. I think, as Jacqueline alluded to, it touches all of us a lot more than we probably realize. And it's going to be exciting to see where the company goes and where Jacqueline goes as a leader.
One of the things that I really appreciated about what Jacqueline had talked about, it seems to me her understanding of what entrepreneurship is from all of the nuances of what an entrepreneur goes through. Being able to recover from the day, understanding what stress loops is, and understanding peer mentors, what the variety of mentors means to an entrepreneur.
And I think when you see a company that's as technical and as advanced as this, I think maybe you expect the person leading it is somewhat of a robot. And that's not the case at all. With Jacqueline, it was great to learn about, all the real life things that she's working on as well. And how these people that are running companies aren't just running companies. They've got a day-to-day life and hobbies and all the same sort of challenges that the rest of us do, in addition to trying to grow and operate, what is in this case, a really ambitious company. I'd like to thank you, Tracy, the listeners, and our guest today, Jacqueline Good of Magnastar, for bringing us all a better understanding of the world of space communications. And we'll see you next time on the Frontier Entrepreneurship Podcast.
This edition of the Frontier Entrepreneurship Podcast was made possible with the support of FedDev Ontario and the Government of Canada. Special thanks to Victoria Pitchler. The executive producer of Frontier Entrepreneurship is Robert Washburn. I'm John Hayden. To find out more, head to our website, ncfdc.ca. That's ncfdc.ca. Thanks for listening.